Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the votes are still being counted, but Nancy Pelosi says she's pleased.
It was so inspiring to hear my colleagues place my name in nomination once again for Speaker of the House.
Also, a federal judge says a Massachusetts jail must provide addiction medication behind bars.
The unanimous opinion of the doctors on the record in this case was that it was medically necessary for our client to continue his methadone treatment so that he could remain in active recovery.
Plus, Massachusetts investigates hospital billing. Some patients say they're getting high medical bills for urgent care and some doctor visits.
He paid her copay and then ended up getting a bill for over $800. Because it was a Brigham practice, they had billed her as though this had occurred in a hospital.
That's all coming up on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're going to start in the nation's capital today, where despite calls for new leadership, Nancy Pelosi has been chosen by House Democrats as the nominee to lead them in the new Congress. Now, a small group of Democrats, led in part by Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton, has been critical of Pelosi. But Pelosi just told reporters moments ago that she's confident she has the votes to become the next speaker in January.
I think we're in pretty good shape. But again, I don't want to make other people's announcements for them. But we go forward with confidence and humility.
Kimberly Atkins is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Herald, and she joins us from D.C. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I know the votes are still being officially counted, I guess. What's the latest?
Yes, I mean, this was expected to be a fairly easy hurdle for Leader Pelosi to clear today in the Democratic caucus, where she just needs a majority to move forward and on to that floor vote, which takes place January 3rd. But leading up to that, there was still a lot of wrangling to be done with some folks who had expressed opposition, including the group that was led by Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. But as the day has gone on, just as the last couple of weeks have gone on, Nancy Pelosi has seemed to be systematically clearing every hurdle in her path to reclaiming the speakership in January. And we saw that happening today.
Yeah. So let's talk about, we'll talk about Moulton in a minute, but you also tweeted that Stephen Lynch, Congressman Lynch, who signed this anti-Pelosi letter that had been circulating, he told reporters that he could be persuaded to support her. How big of a development is that? And what do you think that means?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've been seeing that latest development with Congressman Lynch, who's the other Massachusetts delegation member who had said he was going to vote against her. We've seen Pelosi and her supporters really trying to negotiate and stir up support from within the caucus in the past few weeks, and it seems that the same thing is happening with Congressman Lynch. He's expressed an openness as he continues to meet with her and her supporters that he could come around and support her. We've seen other signers of this list do the same, either say that they are still open or express their support for Nancy Pelosi. We saw most importantly, the one name that was floated, Congresswoman Marsha Fudge, last week came out and said she was supporting Nancy Pelosi. She was floated as a potential challenger. So we've seen systematically negotiations behind the scenes to get people on board to support the leader.
Now, in terms of Seth Moulton, who's been very vocal, we did get a statement from him he maintains that Pelosi will not have the 218 votes necessary to become speaker. But also New York Representative Kathleen Rice put out a statement saying that when Moulton and Kathleen Rice and Ohio Rep. Tim Ryan met with Pelosi to express their concerns, they were, quote, dismissed outright. And that statement goes on from Representative Rice to say, quote, we remain united in our goal of new leadership. So Pelosi was asked about this today, and we have a little bit of tape from that. So let's listen.
Kathleen Rice just put out a statement saying that she met with you.
Excuse me, do you have any questions about our plans and how we go forward?
She just put out a statement saying she met with you, and you dismissed her concerns outright about
leadership transition. Let me tell you something. I'm talking about scores of members of Congress who just gave me a vote, are giving me a vote of confidence. That is where our focus is. Are there dissenters? Yes, but I expect to have a powerful vote as we go forward.
So, Kimberly Atkins, what do you make of that exchange?
Yeah, I mean, Nancy Pelosi's message coming out of the caucus was that of unity. She was really expressing confidence and expressing that the unification of the folks who are supporting her and really wanting to focus on that and being really playing down this opposition publicly in a way that she has been. Look, she did say at one point, look, I've always had challengers. This isn't anything new, you know, sort of a nothing to see here approach to this challenge. But, I mean, to her point, that challenge, as we mentioned, is just seems to be getting weaker and weaker by the moment. And as far as the as Congressman Moulton's statement, it stops a little short of what Congresswoman Rice said, that they were dismissed and that she's going to vote against Pelosi on the floor. Congressman Moulton said that he is still willing to talk to Nancy Pelosi again, and he hopes that they come back to the table, and stop short of saying that he would vote against her. But it's pretty clear that the insurgency that was forming against her is really starting to fizzle.
Hmm. So do you think Seth Moulton will pay a price for this?
Yeah, I don't know. Seth Moulton is somebody who came to Washington as somebody who wanted to challenge the establishment, right? He ran against the Democratic incumbent from the beginning. He was opposed to Nancy Pelosi's leadership. So this isn't anything new for him. This is sort of the claim that he's staked out, and he's not necessarily going to the table trying to win Pelosi over. So I'm not sure how much he suffers from this, whether this encourages somebody to challenge him in his next race. That remains to be seen, and remains to be seen whether he is going to be looking to run for some different office 2 years from now anyway. So I think it's uncertain.
Hmm. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark's up for a caucus vice chair. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I mean, she's getting a lot of support from folks here. You know, it just shows the real strengths of and the real impact of folks from Massachusetts are having here in D.C. For such a small state population-wise, it really has an outsized role when it comes to politics in D.C., and Congresswoman Clark is no exception to that.
All right. Kimberly Atkins, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Herald, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, a federal judge says a Massachusetts jail must provide opioid addiction medication behind bars. We'll hear from Essex County Sheriff Kevin Coppinger. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A federal judge has ruled that a Massachusetts jail must provide addiction medication to a man who's about to serve time behind bars. Judge Denise Casper ruled that the Essex County Sheriff must provide the man's prescribed methadone because she says denying it would be unconstitutional and a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Essex Sheriff Kevin Coppinger says this ruling could have far-ranging effects, and we'll hear from him in a moment. But first, American Civil Liberties Union staff attorney Jesse Rossman joins us. The ACLU filed this suit. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jesse.
Thanks so much for having me on, Deb.
So what's your reaction to the judge's ruling?
This case is really a matter of life and death. Methadone saved our client Jeffrey Pesch's life in his struggle against his disease of opioid use disorder. And so we are grateful and happy to see that he is going to be able to continue this medically necessary treatment.
Hmm. What do you think was the key issue that caused Judge Casper to rule this way?
I think if you look at the record in this case, what you can see is the medical consensus on this issue is clear. And the standard of care for the treatment of this disease is providing medication-assisted treatment. And the doctors in this case uniformly agreed that the standard of care in this case was to continue Mr. Pesci's methadone treatment program, which he has been on successfully in active recovery for the past 2 years.
Now, he is scheduled to start serving a 60-day sentence for violating his probation because he was arrested for driving with a suspended license. And that's supposed to begin next week. How's he doing?
Again, Mr. Pesci is grateful that this order has come down so that he can continue on this medically necessary treatment. And as it stands right now, his hearing on that probation violation is scheduled for December 3rd.
Mm-hmm. Monday.
That's right.
Yeah. And if it is shown that he did violate his probation, he could go to jail for 60 days.
That's right. That's our understanding. Mm.
So if he did go to jail on Monday for a probation violation, would he then be given methadone daily? Do you know the logistics?
So the judge's order simply requires the facility to ensure that he has continued access to this treatment throughout the period of his incarceration. And the best evidence that this can be done safely and securely is the fact that it already is being done both here in Massachusetts and throughout the country. And there are several different ways that facilities have been able to provide this type of treatment to individuals, either transporting them to a clinic where they can receive their dosage on a daily basis or get a week's worth of dosing that they can then take back to the facility, or sometimes bring a clinic that is licensed into the facility to provide that treatment to them. But this has safely and securely been administered throughout the state, in fact, throughout the country, and right here in Massachusetts, MCI Framingham is providing methadone treatment to women who are pregnant and incarcerated at that facility. And pregnant women who are incarcerated at South Bay transport their women to a methadone clinic so that they can receive their dosing there. So there are a couple of different ways that the Middleton facility can be able to make sure that Mr. Pesci is able to receive this medication.
And the reason that's done is because pregnant women could face significant health consequences if methadone is suddenly discontinued. Is that right?
That is right, although as the record in this case shows, forcibly withdrawing someone from methadone treatment can have significant medical consequences for any individual, both pregnant women and others like Mr. Pesci himself.
Some are saying that this ruling has statewide and national ramifications. Do you think so?
You know, this case is significant, and of course, the ruling itself is about saving Mr. Pesci's life, and the judge's ruling means that Mr. Pesci will be able to continue his treatment on this medication. But we certainly hope that facilities both in Massachusetts and elsewhere use this as an opportunity to look at their policies and amend them to ensure that anyone who is suffering from this disease is able to get the standard of care that the medical community unanimously agrees is what should be required.
Jesse, in the past when we've spoken with law enforcement officials, and as I said, we'll hear from Essex Sheriff Coppinger in a moment, but in the past, correctional officials have said it's really difficult to safely administer drugs like methadone and buprenorphine. Those are two of the three medications that are approved for treating opioid addiction right now. And they say it's hard to prevent diversion. It's hard to do it safely. It's a distraction. And they have to balance public safety needs with what's happening, with the medical needs of certain folks who are on opioid addiction medication when they come in. So what would you say to that?
I mean, again, I think the best evidence that it can be done safely and securely is that it is being done safely and securely. And for example, Franklin County has been providing buprenorphine to individuals who are incarcerated there and who have been prescribed it to treat their opioid use disorder since 2016. And they've actually seen a 35% drop in the county of opioid overdose deaths during that time. They also have seen a decrease in illicit drug use and behavioral problems within the facility itself. And, you know, as the record in this case showed, both Dr. Wally, who spoke to the administration of methadone for the women at South Bay, and the doctor who spoke to the administration of
methadone at Rikers Island have said that they haven't heard of a single incident where there has been concerns with respect to safety and security within the facility. There are well-established protocols in place to ensure that this can be done in a safe and secure way. And the judge in her order recognized that the defendants had not pointed to a single reason why this couldn't also be done for Mr. Pesci.
All right. ACLU Staff Attorney Jesse Rossman. Jesse, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks again for having me on.
And for more now, we turn to Essex County Sheriff Kevin Coppinger. He joins us from Middleton. Welcome to Radio Boston, Sheriff.
Good afternoon, Deb. Thank you for having me.
So what's your reaction to Judge Casper's order?
Well, this case is really new ground. If you look at this in the larger perspective, no correctional facility in Massachusetts, and I'm speaking about the prisons, nor the county jails, prescribes or distributes methadone to male inmates. And that's also across the nation, the norm. It is new ground. We're all well aware of the opiate epidemic that's ravishing this country. If you look at, I can speak for myself, but I'll also speak for a lot of my fellow sheriffs here in Massachusetts. We're all trying to do the right thing. We recognize the seriousness of the opiate epidemic. We're trying to save lives. Each of us have, you know, formed their own protocols and programs in order to address what we see as the crises in our county. And we want to do the right thing. But where this is new ground, this is really something we want to just make sure that we're doing it correctly. Now, one thing, if I could just jump right to it, is earlier this year, when the state legislature was crafting part of the new opioid bill, there is a provision in there for a pilot program that is going to be started here in Massachusetts next year. We put a lot of time, energy, and effort, and when I say we, me being the 14 county sheriffs, in cooperation with the state legislature and the governor's office, to craft this because we want to make sure we find the best practices. And going across, going out to those agencies, I don't deny that other agencies are issuing methadone and Suboxone to their inmates. We just want to make sure we do it right. Now, there's a lot of logistical issues here. There's a lot of security issues here. There's a lot of operational, and of course, there's a lot of financial issues here. We have concerns about our whole entire inmate population. Want to make sure they're doing it right. So when I go back to the pilot program, the legislation calls for partnerships, not only the sheriffs and the Massachusetts Department of Corrections, but also bringing in the Department of Public Health, the Office of Medicaid, and the Executive Office of Public Safety. We're trying to bring the best minds we can to make sure we do it. Now, we have to come up with standard protocols by March of 2019, and we'll implement it by September of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure you're going to say, well, how come so long? Again, this is taking time. This is brand new ground.
But what happens Monday if Mr. Pesci is found to have violated his probation and is incarcerated in your facility?
Well, right now, because of this, the possible effects across the board, we're still weighing our options. I have Judge Casper's decision. We've met extensively with our legal team here in Essex County, and we're also in communication with the lawyers from the National Sheriff's Association, because this is a brand new case. There's no case like this before, so we want to make sure that what we do here, because it's going to be taken across the country, and that's going to be probably the new norm. Now, the ACLU has brought two similar cases, one up in Maine earlier this fall, dealing with Suboxone, and one out in Washington State that is still ongoing. That's a class action suit. And these three, without getting into the details of those cases, they're all intertwined. So this is much bigger than just Essex County or Massachusetts. This is as I said before, going across the country. So
right.
We're just trying to put it all together.
But when you're weighing your options and looking at your next steps, I mean, does that mean that you might appeal, do you think? And when might you make a decision? Don't you need to know by Monday when Mr. Pesci could come to your facility to be incarcerated?
Yep, no, we do, and we're working on it. We just received this decision 2 days ago. But as I said before, there's a lot of logistical issues here because it's not just something simple as You know, Mr. Pesci. Now, I know the representative Maceo, you mentioned, what if we take, you know, could we take Mr. Pesci out to his, you know, methadone appointment every day where he's going? Just think of the issues with that. You know, does somebody who has a methadone clinic want us showing up with Mr. Pesci, you know, being in an incarcerated status going there? You know, what if Mr. Pesci, you know, he's what I guess you could call a low-risk inmate, but what if he is a serious felon or some a very violent felon? Do we want to take him out of the jail? You know, folks would show up here, other folks, you know, could possibly show up here with a methadone prescription after this case is finally settled. And what if they show up and they test positive for other illicit drugs? And that's a norm. We do have folks here in our jails, not only here in Essex County, but through our country, who show up and test positive for, you know, heroin, fentanyl, you know, methamphetamines, other illicit drugs on top of the methadone. Hmm. So we need to coordinate with our healthcare workers here. Hmm. You know, but if we could switch a little bit too, because we're not, like I said, we're trying to do the best we can. Now, we have a very, what I look at, a very good program here with our detox program. It's been nationally recognized. We've been awarded. In fact, we recently got awarded a $1.5 million grant for the Department of Justice to help improve our detox program. And in fact, tomorrow I'm going out to Marlboro to talk about and do a presentation with the judge in the Lynn Drug Court. Detox program, very quickly, is a 28-day program working very closely with the drug courts for people with substance abuse disorders, where they come in and, yes, they do detox. And that's under medically assisted withdrawals. We have 24-hour healthcare, professional healthcare workers here. And then we've put the individuals through programming and treatment to teach them the right way. We kind of reset the minds. And then when they leave, we do provide them with medically assisted treatment in the form of Vivitrol.
Right.
Vivitrol is a drug they get in every 30 days, and that blocks the receptors in the brain. It's an antagonist
right.
Medication that, you know, but, you know, we'll prohibit the cravings.
But, Sheriff, I just wonder, do you have a sort of a deadline as to when you expect to make a decision as to what you might do because of this ruling? Is it tomorrow? Is it Friday? When will you decide? Do you know?
We'll decide when after we finish the conversations that I mentioned before with everybody here on our team. And obviously, I have to make a decision by Monday,
right.
If not sooner. But, no, we're well aware of the time frame. But, again, as I said, we want to do this right. And whatever we do is going to have those ripple effects. So we want to make sure we get the best minds possible on that can help us here to make the right decision.
Essex County Sheriff Kevin Coppinger, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have you ever gone to an urgent care clinic for medical treatment? And did you later get a bill that you didn't expect? Well, we'd like to hear about your experiences this hour because apparently this has happened to quite a few people. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey has investigated the billing practices of some hospitals that own some urgent care clinics and private doctor's offices. Healey's office looked at Partners Healthcare and reached a settlement where Partners agreed to improve transparency about its billing. Boston Globe reporter Liz Kowalczyk wrote about this after looking at some of the complaints from patients, and she says it's been tough for people to determine exactly what they owe for medical care.
Most of us on our insurance cards, we have something that says urgent care, and our copayment for urgent care is listed there, and that may be $25 or $50. But what happens in some of these urgent care centers is that you pay that copay, and then you get an additional bill after you get home for a so-called outpatient clinic visit or outpatient hospital visit because that urgent care center falls under the hospital license. And, you know, people's bills for that really vary depending on what they went for. But there have been patients who've complained to the attorney general about bills, you know, in the high hundreds, $800,000, $1,600.
Mm-hmm. Hey, now, it's my understanding the attorney general, the state attorney general, Maura Healey, did look into this and reached a settlement with Partners Healthcare about this. And after that settlement, you filed a Freedom of Information Act request to see some of what these patients were saying and experiencing. So give us a specific example. You said $800, $1,600. For what? What would be done and what would they get that bill for?
Right. Well, first of all, these complaints are, they don't have a tremendous amount of detail. They just contain the basic details. But we can see what they told the attorney general. For example, one woman went to urgent care center in Danvers, connected with North Shore Medical Center, which is a partner's hospital, and paid her copay. I think it was $75, and then was billed. She had an eye injury, and then was billed for an additional $400. In another case, a patient went to a dermatology practice in Chestnut Hill, and she needed a few warts removed from her foot. And this practice, she didn't know this at the time, she said in her complaint, but this practice happened to be owned by Brigham and Women's Hospital. So she paid her copay and then ended up getting a bill for over $800. Because it was a Brigham practice, they had billed her as though this wart removal had occurred in a hospital. So she got billed for an outpatient hospital procedure.
Right. And they're allowed to bill like this, right? Why are they allowed to add these hospital facility fees on when someone's not in a hospital?
So, I mean, in Massachusetts, it is legal, although some insurance companies don't allow it. Many do, but there can be variation by the type of insurance you have. There has been movement in this state to try to outlaw these fees. The Health Policy Commission, which is a healthcare cost watchdog group, they recommend outlawing these fees, you know, in most circumstances because they believe they drive up healthcare costs and that they're not fair to consumers. The legislature here has looked at this and debated this, and there's sort of mixed feelings. Some agree with outlawing these fees, and some feel like there just needs to be better disclosure to patients. You know, why the legislature isn't automatically moving to outlaw them, I can't really say, but I'm confident in saying that the hospitals have likely lobbied pretty heavily against, you know, making these fees illegal.
Hmm. Now, as we said, the attorney general investigated. What came out of that investigation then? What about, if not the legislature, what about the AG?
This is the first time that AG has investigated this practice, and certainly the first time the AG has reached a settlement around this practice. And, you know, this has been going on for, you know, a good decade. It's not new. It's a little newer in urgent care centers because more hospitals are buying them now. But the AG, they did not go for a very large monetary settlement. But what they did do is enter an agreement with partners requiring very extensive disclosure to patients about these fees up front, you know, before they get their care. So more extensive disclosure on their websites, in the physician's offices and urgent care centers, in new patient packages, in appointment reminders. They basically, you know, it's a pretty thorough list of disclosure that they want partners and its hospitals to make to patients. And the AG's office has given them 9 months, so until June, to do that, and says they will be monitoring that. Mm. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
And what does partners say?
You know, partners says that they don't agree. They don't acknowledge any wrongdoing. So, you know, they deny that they violated consumer protection laws. And they say, you know, we have provided this sort of information to patients. And, you know, I think in some cases they have. You know, when I perused their websites, you know, I found a real mix. You know, I think Newton Wellesley Hospital had it pretty prominently on their urgent care website, but I couldn't find this kind of disclosure for the urgent care website in Foxborough at Patriot Place. Mm. So, you know, my sense is that I know medical billing is confusing, and that's what partner says, but I think if this were explained very clearly in detail to patients would understand. And, you know, I think the problem for the hospitals is a patient might decide to take their business elsewhere if they knew they were going to be stuck with a large bill.
Mm-hmm. Is the AG investigating other providers?
They won't say. You know, I did ask them about that. But, you know, wouldn't surprise me. I know that there are other hospitals that engage in this. I've written about this before. I know Leahy Clinic, Tufts Medical Center. I know that these places also charge facility fees for off-site care.
All right. Liz Kowalczyk with the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for your reporting, and thanks for talking with us about it today.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we're asking you, have you ever received a bill with a hospital fee when you didn't go to a hospital? Tell us about your experience by calling us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us in the studio to talk about this further is Stuart Altman, an economist and professor of national health policy at Brandeis. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So tell us about this practice that we just heard from Liz Kowalczyk about regarding hospitals, billing at urgent care, and some private doctor's offices. How common is this?
Well, it's getting more common, and I just have to shake my head. I had a lot to do with the original decision with respect to allowing hospitals to bill facility fees for outpatient care back in the early 80s because the hospitals were claiming that they were treating sicker people. So when they provided outpatient care, they said these are mainly people in the hospital. Well, that was the 80s. Then they began to build up their outpatient practices, and they continued to charge facility fees for all their outpatient care. So more and more people were going to the outpatient part of the hospital and paying the facility fee. Now they've extended it to the urgent care centers. Mm-hmm. So what you see is a decision made 30 years ago to allow hospitals to charge extra rates because they were treating sicker people in the hospital, and allowing them now to do the same pricing way out in these urgent care centers, some of which are not even close to the hospital.
But I don't even understand the rationalization for that, because I thought urgent care facilities were supposed to be a way to reduce some costs. So is it just a money grab? I mean, what's going on?
Well, you know, I mean, hospitals are looking for every which way they can to get money. Their argument, of course, is that others are not paying their costs and therefore they have to do it. You know, you can have, you know, they're justifying this, that they need the revenue. But I think it's grossly unfair to patients. What Liz reported today is just, it's a combination of surprise billing, which I chair the Health Policy Commission, mm-hmm. and we have been very strongly against surprise billing. We thought it was primarily in the hospital and for ambulances, but now we're seeing it. This is a form of surprise billing. People have no idea that they're going to get hit with this facility fee.
Right. So what should people do? What can they do?
Well, I do think it's the responsibility of government at the state level to do something about it. And it's not just transparency, because it has to do with the selection of your primary care physician often. So, I mean, we can make a big deal just about the urgent care center, but I think that's a mistake. I think we have to look at the whole panoply of delivery system options that people face. And they're facing the same problem when they go to the outpatient part of a hospital or another facility. What it is, you know, you go in to see your doctor wherever they are, and there are now more and more doctors are now part of a hospital facility. It's very difficult to find physicians now that are not affiliated with a hospital.
Right.
So what happens is you go to see a doctor and they said, oh, you need an MRI, you need a CAT scan, you need this or that. Go upstairs or go around the corner and get it done. You have no idea that you're winding up paying two or three times more for that procedure than if you went around the corner and had it done in a private practice. And now increasingly insurance companies are saying, hey, wait a minute, we didn't bargain for this. We're only willing to pay a certain amount.
Mm-hmm.
And with people having deductibles and high coinsurance and high deductible plans, even if the insurance company would pay for it, they're not liable for it. And even if they pay it, then it's going to go into your higher premiums. Mm. So this is an issue that really needs to be addressed.
Right. I want to take some calls because we have lots of folks waiting to weigh in here. Jen is calling from Roslindale. Jen, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for bringing up this issue. I've actually had this exact experience when I was in graduate school. I went to a community health center to have an IUD placed and was told it would be covered by insurance, and later received a bill for outpatient surgery for almost $1,000. And as a student, that was really hard to take, and I ended up, it went to collections, and I had to write a letter to the Attorney General's office to get it resolved, and it was a partner center, so I'm really glad that this is being addressed. That was almost 8 years ago now, and so it's refreshing to know that it wasn't, my experience wasn't just a solemn one, but unfortunate as well.
Okay, and you got it resolved, you got it taken care of.
I did, after about 2 years and a lot of certified letters and fighting.
All right. Well, sorry about that, Jen. Thanks, though, for weighing in here. We have some other folks who want to get on, too, who have similar experiences, and I think I want to hear from several of them at once and try to see if there's a common theme here. Deborah is calling from West Roxbury. Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi. My husband was going to an allergist for many years, getting allergy shots. The practice was taken over by Beth Israel Deaconess, and we received a bill for over $8,000 for them to mix the antigen. And this had never been part of the billing before. We questioned it. We called the hospital. We can't get a detailed billing. We're responsible for 10% of it, and our insurance has to pay the rest.
So you've had this done before, and it was never an $8,000 bill. This is the first time you got the $8,000 bill for
never.
The same procedure.
He's been going there for many years getting allergy shots, and as soon as Beth Israel took over, we got an $8,000 bill.
Okay, Stuart Altman, you heard from Deborah, and we heard from Jess getting surprise bills that they're not supposed to get. What can consumers, patients do when this happens?
So, I think we need to recognize that the federal government is now getting involved, and they are no longer willing to pay what they call excessive extra billing, and they are requiring what they call site-neutral payments. And they're going to force hospitals to separate out the bill so that they're only willing to pay the same rate for an outpatient or an urgent center that would have been charged in a regular office visit. Mm-hmm. So if it's going to happen at the federal government, I think consumers need to become more wiser about what's going on in terms of finding out what's the full charge that they're going to be required to pay. Not just the initial amount, like your caller said. And they need to become wiser, unfortunately, in terms of where they go. And it includes which doctors they ultimately choose.
So should a patient say, make sure your doctor's office hasn't been sold to a to a hospital, and make sure that the website, make sure you check the website to see what kind of disclosure there might be, because you might not know if you get sent for that X-ray or blood test whether you're going to get a whopping bill? Is that really what we have to do as patients?
Unfortunately, in the current environment, the answer is yes. You can go on the website of your insurance company, and they are supposed to include exactly what the rates will be to you. So if you have insurance from Blue Cross or Tufts, they are required to provide the actual out-of-pocket costs that you will incur. So I would definitely suggest an individual that's going to have any kind of an activity, procedure, or something, to look on the website of their insurer to make sure that they know what they're getting into.
I want to bring just a quick voice into the conversation here. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and she wrote the book American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She's on the line from Washington, D.C. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this that we're hearing about, this Boston Globe story today, looking at complaints about billing from urgent care centers and some doctor's offices owned by hospitals?
Yeah, we're hearing more and more of this, and I frankly think it's outrageous. And I don't think, when I hear the hospitals say, medicine is confusing, billing is confusing, and yeah, we disclose this. It's really nonsense. I mean, basically, what we're seeing here, and I see this over and over again, I hear it from patients, a patient goes into the office that they've always gone to, have gotten $50 x-rays for years to monitor their lungs, and suddenly they go in one day, and that same x-ray, that same doctor in that same office is now $350,
right?
So seven times as much. And why is that? Because that office or that urgent care center has essentially been rebranded as a hospital, even though it's not a hospital. So why are we paying hospital fees? I mean, I like to make the analogy. It's as if, you know, an airline bought my local bus service and said, oh, now we're going to charge everyone who gets on the bus as if they're flying in an airplane.
Right.
It is not an airplane, and a doctor's office or an urgent care center is not a hospital and shouldn't be allowed to bill as such, frankly.
And so
I think patients are stuck because you're not, you know, and they'll say, oh, we disclose it. Yeah, sure, it's on some website somewhere, and maybe there's, you know, on the doctor's office stationery, they'll say, oh, it says, you know, Dr. X's office is now affiliated with Partners.
Mm.
Well, that doesn't say to a patient, my prices are going to quadruple.
Right.
It's really a terrible situation. I think it's not just confusing. It feels like a scam, frankly.
So what do you think? We heard from Stuart Altman about advice about what patients should do to try to protect themselves. He said, be educated. Watch for that little sign that says this provider is now affiliated with such and such a hospital. Check the websites. What do patients do? And who can make sure that this is not a scam and make sure that this is not a, you know, a way to grab more money from patients?
Well, I think the problem is you would hope that your insurer would say, we're not paying that. But, of course, hospital insurers need big systems like Partners or Beth Israel Deaconess in their insurance system, in their coverage system. So they're not in a good position to refuse fees, even if they feel somewhat extortionate. So I do think this is something that takes the state attorney general, state consumer protection bureau, or the insurance commissioner to address and say, a hospital, you know, an office can't be just rebranded a hospital by changing your stationery. We are not paying for this. What can patients do in the meantime? I think you have to be on guard, and that's really, really unfortunate. When you go into an urgent care center, you can say, am I going to get a hospital facility fee? When you go to your doctor and they send out a good news, you know, we're now affiliated with X, Y, or Z, you have to ask, am I going to be charged a facility fee? Because if so, I may want to take my business elsewhere. But it's getting harder and harder to find doctors who haven't sold their practices because, frankly, it's really hard these days in this world of medical giants to be an individual practitioner or a small group practice because you don't have that bargaining power and you have a lot of paperwork to do. So it's really tempting for doctors to sell their practices and their urgent care centers to hospitals. I always tell them if they do that to try and bargain with the hospital that the hospital won't start imposing fees, but, you know, they're not in a position to do that either. I do think it takes a regulatory solution.
So Stuart Altman, I guess going sort of piggybacking on that, we heard from Liz Kowalczyk at the Boston Globe in the beginning, and she said, you know, frankly, there hasn't been a lot of action on the part of the state legislature regarding this. Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts has investigated, but lawmakers haven't really taken steps here. Do people, constituents, still have to just put pressure on their elected representatives to try to do something about this?
Well, I'm a little more optimistic. I do think the legislature is going to take this on because what's happened is that they were very interested and I think very willing to get more involved in surprise billing. And what this becomes is a form of surprise billing. It's being viewed separately. It's being viewed as, well, this is facility fees being added on. But I think that's a mistake because ultimately the hospital could say, okay, we're not going to add facility fees, but we're just going to raise our rates 150%. Mm. And by the way, we'll sort of separate them out. I do think the legislature, once they realize that this is another form of surprise billing, will take this on. and come up with what I think is a reasonable approach, which is to say, okay, you can charge X plus Y, but you can't make up a number, which is what they're now doing. So both the, you know, both Liz and Elizabeth are correct. To ask the patient alone to take this on is almost impossible in this complicated healthcare environment that we're now in.
I want to get some more callers on the air before we have to go. Sheila is calling from Brookline. Sheila, you're on the air. Sheila?
Massachusetts. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Sheila.
Okay. I moved to Massachusetts 5 years ago, had a foot problem, went through my insurance, found a doctor I could go to, showed up. It turned out to be in Beth Israel, one of their branches I didn't know. Went to the doctor, and he simply gave me a shot in my foot for plantar fasciitis, I think. Yeah. Went home and ended up with a bill. I was supposed to be a $15 copay. I had $125. The whole thing was $500. And I got really irate. I said, I just got a shot. They claimed I had gone to the hospital, that I was just what you're saying, adjunct, whatever. And when I looked at how they broke it down, they charged $300 for post-observation of my foot. All I did was put my sock on and walked out the door. Hmm. I called, complained to everybody I could. No one really cared. And,
So did you, just had to end up paying it?
I just had to pay. I spent a month and a half calling everybody, and nobody cared. They just said, well, that's what they charge. I had no idea it was a hospital facility. He was posted as a podiatrist.
Uh-huh.
And he gave me a shot. That was it. I think the whole thing was 5 minutes.
Wow.
$500.
I want to get one more call in before we have to go. Sheila, thank you. But Stephanie is calling from Dedham. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My experience was recently I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and the doctor's office provided me with a glucose meter. About a month later, I got a bill in the mail for $322 for a meter that cost $19.95 delivered to your door on Amazon. So my problem is I don't believe there's really any transparency. I'm not sure if the hospitals are being charged these irate amounts by vendors or if they're trying to inflate and bill their patients. And I don't think the patients are going to take this on because that's an auditing process that needs to really be done at the institutional level. Yeah. I went into an appointment for my daughter to have her wisdom teeth removed. 5 minutes with the doctor, a $350 bill. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Okay. So I think both you, Stephanie, and Sheila bring up a good point of where these prices come from and what we do about it. Stuart Altman, it's not just facility fees we're talking about. It's $300 for a device that costs $19.95 on Amazon, and it's $300 for a post-surgery exam that took just a couple of minutes. I mean, it's sort of the same thing, but, you know, it's a little bit different. Is it, or how would folks deal with that?
Well, it really is part of the same thing. What's happened, though, unfortunately, and I'm so sympathetic to the callers, is that we always had this really bizarre pricing system in hospitals. And I won't go into the complexity of it, where they have charges and then what different groups pay. And all the powers, like the government, never paid charges. Insurance companies never paid charges. But these charges still sit out there. And now they're being placed on services that are on the outpatient, and they're taking the same charges, moving them to the outpatient, and unlike the power of government or the big insurance companies, the individuals like the ones just called in have absolutely no degrees of freedom. Hmm. So this cannot be done simply by transparency. It needs some rational way of looking at it. We complain a lot about high drug pricing.
Mm-hmm.
this may be worse.
Hmm. I want to let Elizabeth Rosenthal just comment in our last minute or so here. And I should say we just heard from State Representative Donato's office, and who said that they plan to reintroduce legislation on surprise billing in Massachusetts. But Elizabeth Rosenthal, when we hear these sort of exorbitant prices for things that on the market don't cost nearly what patients are being charged for them, it almost begs the question, doesn't this require some sort of federal action?
Well, that would be nice, but a lot can be handled at the state level. I mean, many states have surprise billing laws that I would hope would eventually translate to the federal level, but they're quite effective. I mean, basically, they don't prevent the hospitals from trying to write these charges into bills, but they do say to patients, they hold patients harmless. So basically, the hospital can try and add on a funny surprise fee, and if the insurer says, no,
I'm going to have to cut you off, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. Stuart Altman, economist and national health policy professor at Brandeis. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.